and welcoming you this morning through the sounds particularly of George Michael. Before that, you also heard a little bit of the sound of the duo, the group known as Empire of the Sun with the song Keystone. And ultimately, this is your Sunday morning programming, well, specifically here in our company, that being Eagle FM, on the program that started off at 5 a.m., that being my Sunday morning take, which lasts from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. every Sunday morning. Now, obviously, as we've all woken up and seen, for those of us that have woken up, and for those of us that have seen, obviously, since yesterday, the particularly, soggy weather that we got, or the climate, the soggy climate that now ultimately sort of like still persists here in the capital. Yes, for those of you outside of the capital who might have heard yesterday that rain had fallen in the middle of June. Yes, it's actually weird in the middle of June. Yes, this is true. We did receive some showers yesterday. Was a bit, perplexed, but sort of like caught off guard because it was pretty strong for showers, but it was very abrupt, meaning it was very short, and it just left off. And obviously, being abrupt, short, leaving a lot of water around, it feeds into the cold factor. But nonetheless, you're in my company all the way on up until 7 a.m. and we're obviously here to give you a little bit of a warm feeling in terms of the engagement, the discussion, as well as also the subject matter on my Sunday morning take, which looks at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between. We find ourselves about quarter past the hour of five this morning, and getting into this morning's particular discussion, which is centered a little bit on predominantly on history, but a little bit also in a subject matter of everything else, because it has to do with a notion of preservation, conservation, as well as also ensuring that the particular items, sites, or even nature locations are maintained and kept for future generations. Now, yes, with those particular sort of like magical terms and words that I just used there, not that I use the word magical a lot, I am speaking about an aspect of cultural heritage, or heritage to a great extent. Reason being, back on Friday, for those of you that listened in on the home run on Friday between myself and Helmut, we looked at a notion in terms of technology now being used on, well, it has been used, extensively so far, or by far, in terms of monitoring, in terms of preservation, in terms of combating vandalism and other particular aspects of damaging heritage sites. And as it, the technology has been in use for an extended period of time, obviously. I mean, just even lighting a light bulb or putting a light fixture close to a particular monument is use of technology, because you'd like to see that the thing is still there when you switch on the light at night, So getting into that particular discussion, it actually pushes it a little bit further in this morning's particular segment, because from Friday's particular segment on the home run to this morning's particular segment on my Sunday morning take, we still don't understand where the first instances of heritage protection actually comes from. We don't. Now, I am always interested in the subject matters of where did this come from? Because if you ask the fundamental question of where did this come from, you get to understand how this persists, why this is still there, why it's being practiced still, why it's still in force, why it is still being, shared or communicated or educated or transmitted. And you get to understand, oh, okay, this is the particular scenarios surrounding this. Now, our discussion this morning is actually two parts to it. The first one has to do with like who were the first countries obviously to start this particular scenario. Because just like you preserve, there's also a notion in terms of bringing in new kinds of cultural, I'll use the term artifacts for now, cultural artifacts or installations or items and the likes. Reason being is that buildings also form part of cultural heritage for country, for territory or for peoples. Why do I say this? I mentioned back on Friday specifically that the Alta Vista Fort, the fort here right next to Windhoek High School, is Windhoek's oldest building in terms of the country. I'm a little bit sketchy on whether or not, you know, it might be older than certain particular other installations around the country, because I know there are churches older than that fort. Obviously there was a settlement already at Ludritz before this fort was constructed. I don't know if the jetty is older than the fort even, and certain particular installations at Swakopmund probably could also be older than the fort. So you get my particular drift, guys, in terms of seeing and visualizing, you know, that depending on where you find yourself in Namibia, what would be the oldest building? The oldest building. Now, since we've got something like that, also in the aspect of architecture, because in most cases now, many countries actually celebrate architecture for that matter. And yes, you find a lot of South American countries. You find a lot of, who else is there? A lot of Asian countries. You get into Europe, you find also the likes there in terms of them celebrating culture through architecture or through buildings and building design. Now, heading into our introduction for this morning, I love, and there's a particular social media platform that I follow, and Facebook, it's based upon designs, but knowing as how algorithms work in terms of Facebook's particular algorithm, the moment you start following one particular thing that, you know, pulls your interest, they start flooding you with similar kinds of, you know, notifications of the similar thing. And you later on get confused because they've got similar kinds of account names in terms of, you know, what the account name is. But one of them is one based upon, it's got something like retro design or something like that in that line. And it's based upon architecture that we discussed here on my Sunday morning take, back in May, specifically about brutalism. Now, if you guys remember the discussion on brutalism, it's just bare bones, cement or concrete design. There is no paint or limited paint use. And that's just about it. You know, just building design, construction design, layout, architecture, the whole scenario based upon just using, just concrete and as the basic, in terms of everything, you know, for the final product. And many of it are photos, of installations of buildings, with their building designs that were not, they, in many cases, they don't exist anymore today. They don't exist anymore. In some cases, the building designs showcased, you know, unique, I don't want to say communist era or socialist era designs, but I mean, Romania has got a bunch. Those countries that formed part of the former Yugoslavia have got a bunch of these unique designs and layouts and architecture, and it is beautiful stuff. Even if it's just slabs of concrete that were just thrown together, beautiful stuff. But obviously the photography that took photos of these particular designs shows something. Then there's another particular account that shows aspects of Cape Town, you know, of yesteryear. And I'm talking about photos of color photos and gray photos and black and white photos of Cape Town from the 60s and the 50s heading this way. I mean, it shows you the cars and the particular, you know, layout of certain particular segments of the city itself, the design of buildings that were there that are no longer there, and new buildings are there. The kinds of layout in terms of what the city first looked like before it expanded and became so large and, you know, so big. And obviously, before certain particular policies were obviously, or localized policies in South Africa were obviously be inaugurated in order to achieve certain particular sort of like, you know, socioeconomic outcomes. And we all know of those socioeconomic outcomes because we were also part of that particular pet project. And all those particular things obviously added up. But the photos itself gives you a snapshot in terms of being in a time capsule and being able to see what something looked like before. The same to also, if you guys have ever seen photos of yesteryear of Windhoek. The sort of like the distance, what was the main street in Windhoek back then? And, you know, ultimately what things looked like, guys. I mean, between where the fort stood, Alta Vista, where you know where Independence Avenue is, guys, literally, somehow, two or three hills are missing. And when I say two or three hills, I'm talking about that it was literally flattened down for these pieces of mass construction that you now see being present today to be there. Streets, buildings, layout. Obviously, it also includes plumbing and other and electrical installations. All of these particular things, and you will find those photos. Don't worry, guys. You will find those photos. Those photos are. You can either find them on the internet somewhere. In most cases, it'll be in German or sometimes in Afrikaans or contained on certain particular websites. Or you will have to go into, you know, the National Museum, to basically have a view in terms of what Windhoek looked like in yesteryear. Now, in yesteryear also includes the negative history of what Namibia also experienced back then. Now, as we step into our discussion this morning, dear listeners, we're quickly going to take a short musical break. After the musical break, we're going to come back heading into our discussion in earnest after that introduction that we just had for the past 10 minutes, and we'll be back right after this.
So these are the figurines acting out all the scenes before my eyes. I thought I knew them all by name, but they started looking much the same, and it's no surprise that I don't wanna listen too much. How can I give up on all the days I know I've won? There's nothing but rainbows. I believe in the shadows. Be dropping out, but now I'm gonna work it out. I'm gonna work with me. I'm running like an Appaloosa, then I'm rolling like a rusty ship on a stormy sea. You know the people are saying strange things. Face is down. I don't wanna listen too much. I'm not gonna give up on all the days I know I've won. There's nothing but blue sky. There's nothing but blue sky. Nothing's gonna stop me now. I'm skimming like a skipping stone on a silver lake. Perfect happy clown, you gotta make a mistake. And people are saying strange things, and I don't wanna listen too much, yeah. sun.
Back there from the sounds of Jamiroquai with the song Blue Skies, and that brings us up to 5:30 this morning. And if you've just woken up, I do hope you've got a cup of coffee on you in terms of enjoying this particular morning session and ultimately tuning into your Sunday morning programming, which will take you through the rest of the course of this morning's programming. Now, I also do hope you guys didn't make the mistake that I almost made this morning, but primarily to try and wake up for the FIFA Club World Cup, which actually began this morning, and it's currently taking place in the United States. First match that happened. Supposedly there was an opening ceremony. I didn't stay up to wait. You know, I had to be here and ultimately had to share with you this refined knowledge in terms of cultural heritage and all that. Football can wait. Don't worry, guys. But nonetheless, as we turn back to where we left off in our discussion. Now, the aspects of cultural heritage, not to be confused in certain particular aspects in terms of the literature review that I've got here, not to be confused with cultural heritage, but actually the historic preservation of items, is also known as heritage preservation or built heritage conservation in the United Kingdom. So historic preservation is a term used in the United States, and built heritage conservation is a term used in the United Kingdom. Now, it is deemed as an endeavor that seeks to preserve, conserve, and protect buildings, objects, land, landscapes, or other artifacts of historical significance. Now, it is a philosophical concept that became popular in the 20th century, which maintains that cities, as products of centuries' development, should be obligated to protect their patrimonial legacy. The term also refers specifically to the preservation of the built environment and not to preservation of primeval forests or wilderness, because that ultimately would fall into nature conservation. Remember? Nature conservation could also overlap into this cultural heritage preservation discussion. Why do I say it? Well, there's a very, very lovely example known as Angkor Wat. Now, if you don't know what Angkor Wat is, and if you've never heard of Angkor Wat, Angkor Wat is a Buddhist temple in Siem Reap in Cambodia. However, Angkor Wat is about 162 hectares the air surface area that it covers. That's how big it is, and it's within the Khmer capital city of Angkor. Now, Angkor itself, the Khmer city. Nothing to be confused with Khmer Rouge, you know, the 1960s, 1970 particular sort of like, situation that happened there. But Angkor, the capital city, was the capital city of the Khmer Empire, located in present-day Cambodia. Now, the city and the empire flourished from approximately the 9th to the 15th centuries. The city houses the Angkor Wat, which is a temple that we spoke of, which is one of Cambodia's most popular tourist attractions. Now, the whole city is abandoned. Let me say that again. The whole city is abandoned. The reasons as to why it got abandoned is not as entirely clear. However, they concluded, and this is something that took place in 2007, with particular researchers, they were an international collection of these researchers, and they used satellite photographs in terms of looking at Angkor Wat, or no, at Angkor, sorry. Angkor is considered to be the largest pre-industrial city in the world by surface area, with an elaborate infrastructure system that connected an urban sprawl of at least 1,000 square kilometers. And that's specifically to the well-known temples that are at its core, because the temples are in the middle, but the whole surface area that it covers. Now, Angkor is also considered to be a hydraulic city because it had complicated water management networks. The city was so, what's that term that they love using? Symmetrical. Symmetrical being an even in design and even in layout. They can't, the researchers obviously, because of language, and location and all those particular things. And I mean, most of these researchers are obviously European and North American. They are trying to understand, how did you get such a perfectly laid out city in a period when, obviously, when they look at their particular own history, things were pretty chaotic and the likes. And it's a perfect square, the layout of the city. It's a perfect square. The second thing is, the city's water supply was also state of the art for its particular time frame, because there was only one other known civilization that did a similar thing in terms of transporting water from one point to another, specifically from the water reservoir to the urban settlement itself, were the Romans. And the Roman aqueducts still stand till this day in terms of proof. The Roman aqueducts still stand till this day in many cities in Europe, and in some places of North Africa and of the Middle East. But for Angkor itself, the city had its own particular supply, which rotated around the city. Now, it also used for its water management network, it used the water for systematically stabilizing, storing, and dispersing water throughout the area. This particular network is also believed to have been used for irrigation in order to offset the unpredictable monsoon seasons and also to support the increasing population of the settlement. Now, although the size of its population remains a topic of research and debate, newly identified agricultural systems in the Angkor area, may have supported between 750,000 people to 1 million people in Angkor, in that city. I urge you to read up on that city itself, because you will be astonished, dear listeners, in terms of understanding that there were large populations back then, in certain parts of history back then. So, what are we looking at? What do we see? Now, the aspect in terms of the discussion of nature conservation slightly also overlapping into landscape preservation in the cultural heritage discussion and cultural heritage conservation or preservation discussion is because Angkor had been completely overgrown by the forest, by nature. Nature had completely grown into it. It's been completely taken over. The same too also for many of the particular South American cultural and historical installations. For example, Machu Picchu in Peru, considered one of the highest settlements where humans have lived in the world, in, I think it's in the Andes. It's in the, yeah, it's in, no, it's, yeah, it is in the Andes mountains. And Machu Picchu is still there. Proof of that people live there. Also overrun and taken over by nature, obviously, as nature had moved in. And Machu Picchu is a very cold place to stay in, guys. Much like this morning, particularly, you know, also with the, with the moisture in the air and the cold air specifically. Machu Picchu itself. You get into various other kinds of, scenarios that you'll find strewn across the globe. And it's not just, Greek and Roman, architecture and installations that are strewn across the world, you know, and had been overrun by, nature. You go to places, for example, like in Iran. Besides the Iran, you know, Israel, sort of like shooting each other with missiles and rockets and stuff. There's another discussion about that. On the Silk Road aspect, there are these various installations that run from Iran, westwards, heading into Iraq and to other particular territories of, it's like midway stations for horses and for camels. It's like, okay, back then in history, they had something known as roadside inns. So a roadside inn would have a resting place and a feeding trough for travelers, between various positions and various locations. And there would be stables for horses and whatever other particular, pack animal you would have. And there would be sleeping quarters. There would be a kitchen. There would be some particular sort of like refreshment facilities and the likes. And it was a midway station. Now, obviously, if you understand, the distance, let's say between, what's the furthest I can pick? The distance between Windhoek and Otjiwarongo. You obviously understand that Okahanya is the midway station. You know, the midway stopping point. But imagine the scenario in terms of doing this by horseback. Or doing this, you know, by carriage, you know, you've got an ox pulled carriage. Okahanya would have, you move all the way to Okahanya. Let's say you departed in the middle of the day and you reach Okahanya by midnight or let's say by nightfall. And at Okahanya, you rest, you sleep over, recharge your energy cells. And early in the morning, you depart from Okahanya to Otjiwarongo. That would have been the scenario that I'm explaining to you. Now, obviously, what you're hearing there is how long it takes. How long it takes. And that ultimately has been the scenario that has obviously been shortened because of the invention, the creation of the motor, of the motor vehicle, the, you know, the combustion engine motor vehicle, and the introduction of tarred roads, which follow certain particular routes, because remember, those midway stations could bypass completely bypass a small town, but road networks now obviously have to connect towns to each other in order that supplies, economic services are brought to each of these particular towns, and it's not just there to a station standing there somewhere out there in the middle of the wild. So that's also where town planning, infrastructure planning obviously now took place, and you've got to connect all these particular settlements with each other. Now, in the notion of historic preservation, or as the UK would call it, built heritage conservation, you obviously see that many of these are sort of like, includes paid professionals, or, you know, that people are paid to preserve these things. Now, in historic, preservation, you get performed, this is paid work that is performed by trained professionals, and it can be divided into the practice areas of regulatory compliance, architecture and construction, historic sites and museums, advocacy and downtown revitalization or rejuvenation. Each of these areas have a different set of expected skills, knowledge, and abilities. In the US, you've got about that, there's about 70% of the professional paid practice in historic preservation is in the area of regulatory compliance, which is driven by laws, regulations and guidelines that are obviously, you know, promulgated at the federal, state and local levels. Now, at the federal level, these include the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. That's in the US. Obviously, Namibia has its own particular sort of like, National Heritage Preservation Act, and you get all the associated particular legislations as well. This now, from that particular act itself in Namibia, it also then cascades downwards through the regional council in Namibia, or in Windhoek, for example, but I'll say regional councils nationally in Namibia, and it has to cascade down to your local authorities in each of the localities that they find themselves. Now, do understand, dear listeners, that the local authorities play also a particular role, you know, in preservation of culture, firstly, of historic sites, secondly, and obviously also, remember, as of certain particular landscapes or settings. Now, the downside is, in Namibia, you get a very weird thing. Some particular landscapes are actually in, you know, on private land, but they are being preserved in conjunction or in collaboration or under the sort of like auspices of the National Heritage Council. For example, the rock paintings of the Erongo Mountains that I've spoken about on Monday in our home run presentation back on Friday. In our home run presentation of Friday. Reason being is that you can't remove the rock painting. It's literally built into the mountain, or it's not built into the mountain. It's painted in the mountain or on the side of a mountain. So, you know, in terms of preserving it as it is, that makes it a bit difficult because it's exposed to the elements, which are light or sunlight, wind, rain, dust, storms, or sometimes, you know, those particular aspects and the likes. And it does sort of like impact, you know, the materials or ultimately the installations itself. In other scenarios, sometimes it's water damage that's the issue, because you sometimes get, for example, like the rock painting discussion, they might be in a cave and then there might be a collection of water that builds up in that cave and it ultimately also makes it inaccessible, and thus ultimately the particular installation is lost because of that water. You might argue, well then pump the water out, it's not so easy sometimes. Not so easy. Now, getting into the understanding of the aspect of these items and where it actually began. Now, where it actually began is that in 1790, yes, 1790, Aubin Louis Milan submitted a report to the Constituent Assembly regarding the demolition of the Bastille. Now, if you don't know what the Bastille is, dear listeners, the Bastille is the famous French prison that's situated in the middle of Paris, along with the Cathedral of Notre Dame. But the gentleman itself, this Milan, was a curator in terms of, you know, looking at antiques and obviously, you know, cultural preservation and the likes. And he submitted as a, you know, art historian, or if we can call it like a cultural historian, he submitted a proposal, regarding, or a report regarding the, you know, the historic relevance of buildings and other particular sites. Now, the Bastille, dear listeners, was also famous. It's actually a fortress, but it was famous for also playing a pivotal role during the French Revolution, because it was the state prison by the kings of France, and it was actually stormed a year before the previous year in 1789, you know, during the French Revolution, in order to free some of the people that were arrested by the authorities. Now, Millin submitted his report using the term monument historique, and the idea of preserving sites linked to the Ancien Régime, not the Ancien Régime, and it was a French term, obviously, was the political and social system of the Kingdom of France that the French Revolution actually overturned through its abolition in 1790 of the feudal system of the French nobility, and in 1792 through its execution of the French king, or the last French king, Louis XIV, sorry, and the Declaration of the Republic. Now, and ultimately, it also placed under impetus of Talleyrand, the Assembly, and on the 13th of October that year, it created the Commission des Monuments, whose function was to study the fate of monuments, arts, and sciences in the First Republic of France back then. The next year, in 1791, Alexandre Lenoir was appointed to create the Musée des Monuments Français, which is the Museum of French Monuments, which opened in 1795 and exhibited fragments of architecture Lenoir had saved and salvaged from destruction over the previous years. The museum was ultimately closed during the restoration by Louis the 18th. And its collection was returned to the, no, that's Louis the 19th, sorry. And its collection was returned to the original owners and their families. Now, the vandalism and the widespread destruction which accompanied the French Revolution had inspired several such responses. And the first known register of such buildings was an inventory of the castles, which was begun by Louis the 16th by the Conseil des Bâtiments Civils, which is the civil council, the Council of Civil Buildings, which was completed in 1795. Now, between 1804 and 1834, several archaeological societies were formed, notably the Société des Antiquaires de France in 1804, and the Société Française de Archéologie in 1834, and the Comité des Travaux Historiques et Scientifiques also in 1834. If you don't know what I just said, the one was for antiquities, the one was for archaeology, and the other was for scientific, sort of like installations. In 1819, the French Ministry of the Interior provided an allowance for Monument Historique for the first time, and on 21 October 1830, François Guizot, who was then the Minister of the Interior, proposed the creation of a post, the Inspector General of Historic Monuments, to classify buildings and distribute funds for their preservation, back in 1834, or in 1830, dear listeners. This is ultimately where this exercise of cultural preservation, or overall, cultural heritage management actually comes from. Before then, please, and this is actually a good explainer at this time. Do not confuse it for artifact collection or for art collection. Do not confuse it for artifact or art collection, because artifact and art collection actually translates to, this could be a private collector. And there are a lot of these particular private collectors, specifically in the Northern Hemisphere. Do not confuse them for private collections. That may be construed as preservation or as heritage preservation in some scenario. It may be construed. However, it's the accessibility element that becomes questionable, because cultural heritage or cultural installation management is all about that your whole public in your country knows about this particular aspect, sees it, and actually they do have an aspect of accessibility to it. Not a question of, yes, I collected, or I've got the, you know, this, the club of whoever, you know, whatever particular sort of like indigenous leader as a cultural heritage artifact, and it's in my private collection, and I only show it to my friends and my family. And it's there, you know, kept in some sort of a storage facility at home, and you know, that's just the way it goes. No, that in its own right is not cultural heritage management. That is artifact collection. That's private artifact collection. Another one, for example, would be the Bom Jesus discussion we had also back in May, or was in April, back in April. Bom Jesus obviously translates from Portugal, or Portuguese, to the good Jesus. The ship that was discovered in 2008 in, close to Oranjemund, by mine workers, and obviously its particular preservation, how a shipwreck gets preserved. But here's another thing. Its contents as well, which are all precious metals. They're all treasures. They've got specific value. That too forms part of the discussion. And that is cultural heritage preservation and management. We step into the UK scenario as well, where in England, antiquarian interests were a familiar gentleman's pursuit since the mid-17th century, which were developed in tandem with a rise in scientific curiosity. Now, you had fellows of the Royal Society who were often also fellows of the Science Society of Antiquaries. Many historic sites were damaged as the railways began to spread across the United Kingdom. These sites included the Trinity Hospital and its church in Edinburgh, Furness Abbey, Berwick, and Northampton Castle, as well as the ancient walls of York, which were built by the Romans, Chester, and Newcastle. In 1833, Berkhamsted's castle became the first historic site in England to be officially protected by statute, meaning by law. Under the London and Birmingham Railway Acts of 1833 to 1837, and though the new railway line in 1834 did demolish the castle's gatehouse and the outer earthworks to the south. Now in 1847, the Shakespeare's Birthplace Trust, yes, Shakespeare's birthplace is still standing till today. It is preserved till today. Was formed by a local act of parliament, and the Shakespeare Birthplace and Sea Trust Act of 1891, to prevent the Stratford property sale to an American showman, P.T. Barnum. The house still stands till this day. Shakespeare's birthplace. Another early preservation event also occurred at Berkhamsted. In 1866, a British nobleman by the name of Lord Brownlow, who lived at Ashridge House, this is another particular sort of like one of those oldish particular installations, at Ashridge House, and if any of you have ever watched, what is its name? What's the TV show's name? Well, anyway. Tried to enclose the adjoining Berkhamsted Common with a 2 meter steel fences in an attempt to claim it as part of his estate. Now, in England, from early Anglo-Saxon times, common land was an area of land which the local community could use as a resource. Now, across England between 1660 to 1845, 7 million acres of common land had been enclosed by private landowners by application to Parliament. On the night of 6 March 1866, Augustus Smith, an MP, led gangs of local folk and hired men from London's East End in direct action to break the enclosure fences and protect Berkhamsted Common for the people of Berkhamsted in what became known nationally as the Battle of Berkhamsted Common. Now, you've got to understand, dear listeners, there are also on this particular piece of land, pieces of historic installation as well. just, you know, so that you understand it. So that it led to that in 1870 that a gentleman by the name of Robert Hunter, who later on became a co-founder of the National Trust in 1895 and the Commons Preservation Society, succeeded in legal action that ensured protection of Berkhamsted Common and other open spaces threatened with enclosure. In 1926, the Common was acquired by the National Trust. Now, the National Trust in the UK sense is a heritage and nature conservation charity and membership organization in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, similar to our National Heritage Council. You step into, just before we actually reach the top of the hour, you step a little bit into the dimension of English heritage. Now, you're going to ask me, what is English heritage? Now, English Heritage is a charity that actually manages over 400 historic monuments, buildings, and places in the UK. And it was formed in 1983. And it was registered as a charity that looks after the National Heritage Collection of England. Now, this comprises of over 400 of England's historic buildings, monuments, and sites that span more than 5,000 years of history. And within its portfolio, you find Stonehenge, which is one of the most unexplained particular installations in human history. Because still today, no one knows why this thing was installed. You find Dover Castle, one of the other particular sort of like historic sites in England as well. And then you've also got a Tintagel Castle, that is also part of the heritage installations of yesteryear in England, and obviously the best preserved parts of Hadrian's Wall. And if you don't know who Hadrian was, Hadrian's Wall was a physical wall constructed by the Romans and the Roman Emperor Hadrian in AD 122. Now, it is a defensive fortification of the Roman province of Britannia. That's obviously when the Romans were there. And its construction began in 122 AD in the reign of the Emperor Hadrian. Now, it ran from Wallsend on the River Tyne, which is on the east coast of the United Kingdom, in the east to Bowness on Solway in the west of what is now known as Northern England. And this was a defensive fortification against the Celtic tribes that lived on the other side of that wall specifically. In the next particular segment that we'll obviously be taking a look at, we'll be looking into a discussion based upon the development of cultural heritage preservation across the world. And also be taking snippets from other parts around the world, specifically from the Netherlands and also from the aspects of the United States and other countries as well, in order to get a little bit of some insight in terms of, you know, ultimately what it looks like. Now, remember, I've indicated to you landscapes, which can include land, construction sites or aspects of constructed areas, as well as also other particular aspects like other monuments and the likes, which can also include military installations for that matter, in terms of your cultural heritage preservation. We take a short musical break and we come back right after that.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it, view it, code it, jump, unlock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, start format. It. Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, chart it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip and zip it. Lock it, fill it, call it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it. Technologic. 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 Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, hook it, crank it, drop it, zip and zip it, lock it, fill it, go it, find it, cue it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, close it, pick it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, flip it, crack it, drop it, zip and zip it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it. Switch it, scroll it, close it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it. Lock it, fill it, go it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, tap it, work it, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, rewrite it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, ring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, tap it, work it, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, flip it, crack it, drop it, zip and zip it, surf it, scroll it, close it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, tap it, work it, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, crack it, drop it, zip and zip it, surf it, scroll it, close it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, tap it, work it, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, crack it, drop it, zip and zip it, lock it, fill it, go it, find it, cue it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, close it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it. Technologic. 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 Technologic.
And we come back there from the sounds of the War on Drugs with the song Holding On. Before that, you had a little bit of, a little bit of electronic dance move injection there from Daft Punk with the song Technologic, ultimately, which brings you up almost to the time of quarter past the hour of 6 a.m. And if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. And obviously, I do hope that you've got a hot beverage in close proximity to your, you know, wherever you stretch your arm out to in whichever particular direction. Or ultimately, it is ultimately in a cup form in your hand. Now, on the discussion, obviously, of certain particular aspects of heritage preservation, there's a whole bunch that obviously exists besides just France and the United Kingdom that I mentioned. The United States has got both historic districts, national historic landmarks, national register of historic places. I mean, they even confiscated a Civil War general from the Confederate side, what's the guy's name? Lee. General Lee. I first need to get his full particular name, but they confiscated part of his, farm, which was located in the state of Virginia, and converted part of it actually into, as a Civil War cemetery, you know, for the soldiers that died during the American Civil War. Because Lee was one of the most, you know, sort of like, central figures of the Confederate Army, who were primarily, you know, in many cases considered to be the bad guys back then. And obviously, if you understand what the American Civil War was all about, it was technically about the emancipation of American slaves, ultimately, to vote. Lincoln wanted to expand the voting base for voters in America back then, and there were some political actors that were against this particular move. And Robert Edward Lee, that is his full name, the general's name, he was the main general of the Confederate Army. He was a Confederate general during the American Civil War, and he was appointed as the overall commander of the Confederate forces. Now, on the historic side of things, in terms of the development of the concept of architectural heritage conservation and its inspirations, it's nothing new that UNESCO is sort of like the global particular authority on this particular scenario in terms of the protection of various kinds of sites, which also include architectural installations. Many of it ultimately does feature or factor in as architectural installations of yesteryear that have stood the test of time. This includes the pyramids of Giza, for example, like in Egypt, the Sphinx, also in Egypt. Or most Roman installations back then of yesteryear, across the Mediterranean, you go into places of Asia, Taj Mahal is one, Angkor itself, like I said as well, is also one. You go into other places, you come to Namibia as well, and so the list goes on. Now, particular research document that was authored by three authors by the name of Wen Liang, Yahya Ahmad, and Hazrina Haja Bava Mohadin. They authored this back in October of 2023, which is on the, and it was placed within the resource's name is Built Heritage. And they noted specifically that the UNESCO itself, and this is not me promoting UNESCO, but, you know, just highlighting what they sort of like discovered or realized in terms of their research that UNESCO itself has been exploring and guiding the conservation of the environment, cities and buildings since they were established. That's now the agency of the UN. And that they've accumulated a wealth of experience doing so as well. Because since the start of the century, which was in 2000, experts from UNESCO's World Heritage Committee have thought it was time to shift the process of architectural heritage conservation. They are gradually becoming aware of the objective reality of urban development, that historic cities are facing conflict between conservation and development, and that architectural heritage conservation can no longer focus only on the conservation of buildings. The conflict between sustainable development and heritage conservation is a balancing act between preserving the importance of heritage and allowing the sustainable development. They also noted, for example, that the recommendation on the historic urban landscape was also created. And this was something a little bit earlier, just between the 2000s, or since 2000 this way. Back in 2011, UNESCO had adopted the recommendation on the historic urban landscape, which addresses the negative impact of urban development on heritage conservation and the contradictions and problems between architectural heritage conservation and modern urban developments. Now, these three authors noted that the specific aspect that UNESCO developed in 2011, the recommendation on historic urban landscape, argues that rigid and dogmatic conservation strategies need to be adapted to a city's social context and its economic environment. History and development should not be opposites, but rather mutually beneficial, and that the historic urban landscape is an approach that incorporates both the historical environment and contemporary space into the conceptual scope. Now, the important thing here that you also have to take a particular look at, dear listeners, is the manner in which this obviously has to take place. For example, in last year, 2024, at the start of April of 2024, I went to a particular engagement specifically with the executive director of the Ministry of Education. She's now obviously the Minister of Education. That now being Minister Steenkamp, when she was the executive director last year. She attended an event specifically, and it was about the Alteveste Fort, this fort here at Windhoek, and that the fort will be, you know, repurposed. But obviously the notice that we received as the media was not about, yeah, who will be speaking there. It just said you are invited. Obviously you guys, I know I always share this, how we, the media, get invited. It only says, yeah, you guys must be there. Come check. And when we get, we don't know who's going to speak. We don't know who will be, who are other people or peoples or parties that will be attending. You just get like an explainer saying what the event is about. A short oversight or descriptor or description of, you know, what this is, what this factors in or what it tries to explain, and date, time, venue, and get there. That's it. In many cases, obviously, it does highlight that we, the media, are pretty privileged in terms of the invites that we get, and so forth. Now, working from that particular explainer that I just highlighted to you there. So I show up at the event at the Alteveste Fort at the engagement, and I see the executive director is there, and another director is also there from the directorate in the Ministry of Education. And the American ambassador shows up. And I was like, huh? And then one or two other people also show up. And then I see now, obviously, because it was explained obviously in the media invite, you know, that this is about, a donation that'll be done by the US embassies. So we went there in terms of, okay, the US embassy is donating X amount of money for this particular, sort of like sprucing up of the fort itself. Get there. And they speak about, you know, how these kinds of installations in Namibia need to also now be, it's a question of repurposing also to meet a specific need in changing times, and ultimately because certain changing landscapes also, certain changing elements also occur within certain aspects of Namibia's economic sphere, which was at that stage that the craft market that is contained within the old brewery complex there in Tull Street and between Tull Street and Independence Avenue. If you guys know where it is, you know what I'm talking about. The craft market has to move from there, obviously, because the new owners of the property had highlighted to all those tenants in there, you guys have to bounce a little bit earlier. And ultimately, that's what led to that particular discussion taking place right there. From that particular scenario, the fort, the Alta Vista fort was designated because the Alta Vista fort had just been standing closed most of the time, dear listeners. And, you know, obviously with the Reiterdenkmal, if you don't know what the Reiterdenkmal is, the Reiterdenkmal stood where the Independence Museum is now currently positioned, right opposite the Christuskirche. The Reiterdenkmal is the monument in honor of the German colonial forces, you know, the guy on the horse. That's the Reiterdenkmal. The Reiterdenkmal stands in the middle of the fort now, because it was moved to in the middle of the fort. And the fort, well, now obviously was back then in 2024, last year, the discussions that were presented at that particular media invite or discussion was that the fort, or parts of the fort will be renovated to accommodate the people from the, you know, the vendors from the craft market to be positioned there, and that there was an appeal made to further donations in order to spruce up the rest of the facility in its entirety. Now, that particular subject matter, dear listeners, obviously shows you changing times, changing needs, changing uses, changing purposes, ultimately leading to readaptation, renovations, sprucing up, facelifting and all that of various kinds of historic sites and the likes. In many cases, it's also restoration in many cases in terms of meeting certain particular needs. Restoration can include, for example, like connecting services like, you know, water and electricity in order so that the thing is completely electrified, as well as also allowing certain particular kinds of activities to be conducted within these particular installations. Now, what I'm explaining right there to you, dear listeners, is a notion of view the changing times within which these installations continue to exist. The Christuskirche is still an active church, for example. It's still an active church. However, it is also one of Namibia's particular monument installations, for that matter. It's also one of its most, you know, cherished monument installations. And if you did not know this, it was between the Kudu, which is right there, and John Maynard Street, on the intersection of John Maynard and Independence. It's the Kudu. It was the Reiterdenkmal, and it was the Christuskirche, which were Namibia's three most outside in the world. It was the Namibia's three most recognizable monuments. Now, they just give you a screenshot or a snapshot of a photo of someone that is owned, which because it's intellectual property of someone else, it's someone else's photo, of where the desert meets the sea. Now, Namibia is not just the desert meets the sea. Unfortunately. That's not the only thing Namibia is good for. Not just the desert meets the sea. Another particular position also, that obviously comes from that UNESCO, you know, the discussion of recommendation on the historic urban landscape, discussion that they highlighted there, is that you obviously have to look at the impact that they were trying to look at. Because there's one, yes, that document, because I'm viewing it, that document does exist. It has to exit, obviously. But there is a development that took place between when it was brought out in 2011 and 2022 and 2023. In 2022, UNESCO had a report on member states' survey on the implementation of the recommendation of hysteria on the historic urban landscape. And in 2023, it was financing sustainable urban futures for all. They celebrated in 2023 World Cities Days on 31 October. And in that discussion, the World Heritage Cities Program celebrates World Cities Day 2023 through ensuring inclusive economic benefits of urban heritage. And yes, there is always urban, there is always economic benefits that can be accrued or that can be facilitated or actually generated. Because we see it in the tourism sector in Namibia. The living museums, the rock art installations that I spoke of back on Friday and on and earlier this morning. And these particular discussions obviously always indicate towards someone is spending money to come and see it. Now, what would be a lovely thing? And this is another sort of like an appeal that I'm highlighting. Is that if these, some of these particular things, for example, were open on Saturdays, because I would also like to go and, you know, walk into our museums and go view some stuff, because it shouldn't be treated like an 8-to-5 scenario. I mean, some of us, you know, obviously work during the week. We'd like to see things on weekends as well, you know? Just a small appeal. But nonetheless, now, in the discussion, obviously, of the urban heritage landscape discussion, just so that you know, give you a snippet into this. It was all about improving the implementation of historic urban landscapes. Now, a total of 187 responses from 69 countries were obviously factored in or received, marking a significant increase from the second consultation, which took place in 2019. Now, this is obviously as UNESCO held 24 capacity building workshops with local authorities and focal points to support them in their surveys. Now, based upon the responses, UNESCO noted that it addresses the management of historic cities and settlements in a way that aligns with the 2030 agenda of sustainable development. Now, what they also highlighted is that it covers six areas of implementation: strengthening governance mechanisms and planning tools, inventorying of local heritage values and attributes, fostering inclusive and participatory decision making, developing equitable economic benefits, responding to climate change impacts, and building capacity in the use of digital technologies of urban for managing urban heritages. Now, the fostering of digital technologies also factors into the discussion we had on Friday, Helmut and I, on the home run, where satellite technology, as well as also certain particular photographic technologies and even digital technologies like websites and what's that 24-hour website mechanism that they always use? This is ultimately how it allows you to view in real time what the site also looks like. Now, it's not like a video recording or a video transmission. No. It's just satellite indicator that shows you the actual size of, let's for example say, protected landscape, which could be a conservation area or conservancy. And it also shows you the difference between the different zones, because you'll have like a buffer zone around a protected landscape. And then you'll have the protected dimensions of the protected landscape itself. Now, the buffer zone serves as a means of, you know, ensuring that there is an element of true conservation, that the conservation doesn't take place within the immediate vicinity, for example, like three meters around a site. No. It's literally that there's at least 100 to 200 meters around the site that actually acts as a buffer zone in terms of protected grounds or protected area. Now, this can be for a myriad of things. For example, if you take the abandoned city of Angkor, around Angkor, it would be something like a 1 or 2 kilometer radius in every direction around the site, which ultimately shows you that that would be considered conservancy land and that the site itself is the protected landscape itself, the protected urban landscape itself, because it was an urban area. It was a city, from what I shared with you a little bit earlier. And all these particular indicators, you can obviously see how things have advanced since the French, what's that French gentleman in 1790, decided to submit a proposal and a report to say, listen, let's consider this a monument. From then, this particular discussion up to now in 2025, how this particular thinking had also advanced in terms of the technologies that you can use, surveillance, obviously, and management and monitoring and evaluation, as well as also the kinds of activities that you can allow. Now, we'll quickly be taking a short musical break, dear listeners, and we'll be coming back right after that.
You might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Now, Now we come back there right after the ad break, as well as also the musical break, and it leads us into the last quarter of this morning's programming here on my Sunday Morning Take. Dear listeners, where we take a look at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, in order to help understand technically how things work and function around us. Now, I left off on the UNESCO's particular resource known as the Urban Heritage for Resilience discussion, which actually forms part of the historic urban land or the implementation of the historic urban landscape recommendations discussion that actually took place back in 2020. Well, it was updated in 2023 because it actually started in 2011, as the researchers themselves also highlighted. And we factored into the economic uses ultimately that should be accrued, because in many cases, dear listeners, you can see it doesn't really make any sense ultimately if you just leave the lights on, the water is running in there, and who's going to pay for those particular accounts? So the mechanism, the installations ultimately have to generate some sort of an income. Now, I've heard, for example, in the Erongo Mountains rock art discussion, that tour groups specifically come and view rock art that's hundreds of thousands of years old. Yes, in terms of the age, yes. In terms of the, in terms of how accessible it is to us, to anyone else, it's pretty much a very long drive from wherever you find yourself, because you've got to drive to Omaruru, and from Omaruru you've got to get onto a secondary road, and that'll take you to the Erongo Mountains, you know, which is a good 60 something k's away from, kilometers away from, I think from Omaruru, yeah, from Omaruru, yes. Okay, not hundreds of thousands of years. I'm slightly lying there. Slightly off in terms of its, you know, particular age illustrations. But just so that you guys know, we've got rock art that's between 2,000 to 6,000 years old specifically. Well, they say 2,000 to 6,000 years. Some of the particular things are actually, you know, slightly older. We're talking about 27,000 to 23,000 years old. And this even comes through from the personal website of a renowned historian of Namibian, of Namibia and Namibia's particular aspects, Klaus Dirks, Dr. Klaus Dirks, because he set up a website himself about Namibia and everything historical related to Namibia. The oldest rock paintings can be dated between 27,000 to 23,000 before Christ BC in Namibia, and it can be inferred that the populations responsible for these remains did hunt and gather in those particular scenarios. So you obviously have to understand the rock art of northwest and central Namibia as well, which are found in the Erongo Mountains, Brandberg, Spitzkoppe, Tweefontein, and in Rhino Desert. And all of it ultimately has, you know, instrumental or very impactful historical value for that matter. The question is, most of these things are also, most of these particular sites that I mentioned, Erongo Mountains, Brandberg, Spitzkoppe, Tweefontein, and Rhino Desert, are all protected areas as well, which actually factors into the particular, you know, discussion that took place back on Friday in terms of the uses of technology and the likes, because the most accessible way sometimes is just by a small farm road, a small dirt road, a two-track, to get to the site and be able to visit the site and ultimately to see it. But then you also need a guided tour, because there's obviously also the particular threat that normal tourist vandalism can actually wreak damage to, or cause damage to, the particular, you know, the integrity of the site itself. That's on one side. Other particular installations and scenarios, for example, one that is still within the in terms of use, in everyday use in Namibia, is the Tintin Palast, which is known as the Parliament Complex, or the Parliament Building Complex. The Tintin Palast was literally where the German administrator, the colonial German administrator lived, Leutwein. Was it Ferdinand Leutwein? Yeah, Ferdinand Leutwein. It's where Lloyd Vine lived and stayed. This is where they would have stayed. The Tintin Palace now obviously features as Namibia's particular center for lawmaking, where you've got the parliament, which is now known as the parliament, obviously. The National Assembly is in the Tintin Palace. The National Council is in the, they've got their own particular sort of like building behind the Tintin Palace. And all of that obviously factors in as Namibia's sort of like lawmaking hub. That whole scenario there right next to Winterkai School in terms of our country's particular, legislative generating site. There are obviously all still more particular historic buildings across Namibia, obviously, that are still in existence. You can go down to Betani, you can go down to Gibeon, you can go down to Lüderitz, you can go down to Walvis Bay and the Swakopmund, you can go down to, who else is there? There's another particular historic site somewhere also in Namibia. I just need to remember it. Oh, you can go to Tumep itself. Tumep itself also has a whole bunch of historic sites as well. You can go to Skeleton Coast is obviously also one because of the shipwrecks. That's why it's known as Skeleton Coast. There's another one I'm missing. However, when you get to these particular sites, dear listeners, the discussion that you've always got to keep in mind is, you know, where to next? How long more? For how long more will this particular site still be able to exist in its current format? Heroes Acre obviously factors in as the newest installations because many people would obviously be saying, yeah, what about Heroes Acre? Yes, Heroes Acre as well, but Heroes Acre doesn't have the age benefit that most of the sites that I just mentioned actually have. Why I say the age benefit is because, yes, it needs to have weathered a little bit. It needs to have, you know, stood very long. Many people will come and say, yeah, some people are probably 10 years old now, and so forth in terms of, you know, the correlation between Heroes Acre's inauguration and obviously how old it is currently right now. I think it's more like 15 years now, Heroes Acre. But it's a bit of a weird monument because the one time I went there with my siblings, because we were two, it's my sister and my younger brother and I, we tried to drive there to go and visit Heroes Acre, and it was on a public holiday, and it was closed. And that's one of the saddest things ever. You obviously know that most heritage sites in Namibia are, what you call it, they are under sort of like the management of obviously some of the government offices. But for the government offices, obviously, you know, for a heritage site to function and to make money, be open on public holidays and on weekends as well. Because how then do you expect people to know about the heritage in your country if families can't, you know, go for a walk about and go view a museum, your national museum, or they can't go and view a heritage site for that matter? Because one of the particular things in terms of the direction and ultimately the, you know, how things are treated in Namibia, and this is a direct criticism. It's constructive, but it's a direct criticism, is that it's treated like 8 to 5, 1 to 2, Monday to Friday mentality, which is a bit wrong because if you go to other countries in the world, they know that the tourism sector is directly linked to their cultural heritage sites or to their heritage sites or to their particular sort of like various installations across their countries. And it's there between certain times of the day. Obviously, it's accessible. But yeah, that's just one of the particular sort of like takebacks. Now, it brings us into the last 5 minutes this morning, dear listeners, here on your number one talk radio station. We're taking a musical break that'll take us all the way up to the top of the hour at 7 a.m., and then that'll bring us to the end of my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM. I still don't see it, the first, you know, sparks or rays of light coming through ultimately this morning, because obviously that would just indicate how powerful the, what do they call that thing? the sunlight or the, you know, how powerful, not the sunlight, how powerful the clouds are blocking the sunlight in that notion. On that note, dear listeners, we'll be back, well, at the top of the hour after this musical break.
Still so far to go, and I can't feel my toes when the rain soaks through the heels and slips to the sole. Yeah, the blades are 2 feet tall. Waiting green, I'm moving forward to where God only knows. Feel the wind's harsh refrain, like the clouds grip my face, saying it's alright to run from all this pain. Oh, and when it's time to go, with one last breath that's in my lungs, scream it's all for love, scream it's all for love. Come and kiss me soft. Just a dream, I can see it up ahead, where the sky meets the ground. After that, there's only moving gray. I'm filled up with regret, the things I did or never said. Just leave that well alone and come kiss me soft. Whoa. Just a dream. It was just a dream. It was just a dream. It was just a dream. Was it just a dream? Now I'm standing on the edge, gazing into hell. Or is it something else? I just can't tell. When there's nothing left, I close my eyes and take one step. Say, well, here it goes. Say, well, here it goes. Come and kiss me soft. Water. Oh, finally I feel it. 3 or 4 degrees, I'm free and soft. Water. Embrace the deep and leave everything. It was just a dream.
Need lightning fast internet? Piratas has you covered. The network Namibia relies on. Whether for business or pleasure, Piratas' cutting edge technology ensures both reliable and speedy internet connectivity. We exist to serve your needs through our high quality network and pride ourselves in offering client service excellence. Connect to Piratas today. Visit us online at piratas.africa/Namibia or call us on 083-300-1000. Always, always pretend.
And ultimately, that brings us up to the top of the hour, that obviously being here at 7 a.m. And it brings us to the end of this morning's engagement, specifically of my Sunday morning take. We'll still be turning into some of the tunes ultimately from now up until 9 a.m. But stay tuned in the rest of your Sunday morning programming here on your number one talk radio station. Let's see each other again, same time, same place next week. Alternatively, you can catch me and Helmut during the course of the week on the Home Run here on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM.